couple of weeks ago in Columbia, Missouri, a conversation hosted by Harvest Public Media about food production turned into a conversation about semantics.
Words matter. Is it global climate change or global warming? Is it marriage equality or gay marriage? Words matter.
So how does this apply to how we talk about our food? One example taken straight out of recent headlines is it pink slime or lean beef trimmings? And don't forget one of the most successful examples of this.
Factory farm. In two words, you conjure up all kinds of images that may or may not be accurate, but that in the future provides a filter for consumers to understand the debate.
I'm Jabalani LaFall, and we'll discuss the divide between how food producers and food consumers understand industrial agriculture. That's on today's Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. There are lots of different ways Americans talk about food production and farming, and like any other arena, that conversation is becoming increasingly divisive. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today on the show, a look at the messages and motives behind farm and food controversies. We'll spend most of the hour listening back to a program previously recorded at Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. The event called Digest This was presented by Harvest Public Media along with partner station KBIA earlier this month. And to digest the themes of this event, I'm joined now by Peggy Lower, reporter for Harvest Public Media. Welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning, Jabalani.
What was the idea behind this forum, this event?
Well, what we wanted to do here at Harvest Public Media is look at how everyone's talking about food. There are a lot of buzzwords now. There's a lot of controversy. I would even suggest it's kind of the new politics. It can be very red state, blue state. So we wanted to take a look at how people are talking about it. Do you say pink slime? Or do you say lean beef trimmings? You know, it's that kind of thing. So we wanted to talk about why this is so hot and why there are these extremes. And we just had this great event and great panel discussion in Columbia at the Broadway Brewery, which really brought on a lot of heat.
A lot of heat. For instance, there are people that fall into the pink slime area and people that fall into the leaf. The lean beef trimming area.
Absolutely. And I think that when you populate your panel with people on many of the extremes, that's what happens. For instance, we had Bruce Friedrich. He's Senior Director for Strategic Initiatives at Farm Sanctuary, and he's very, very anti-meat. You know,
That's a farm animal protection organization. That's
exactly. Why. Animal rights. And then we had Mike Adams. He's host of AgriTalk, and it's basically the kind of advocacy journalism you find in farm country, which is he's very pro-producer, pro sort of the companies that you would suspect support big agriculture, like Monsanto and that kind of thing. Then we had Chris Chin, a hog producer, and she's a fifth-generation farmer. She's a member of Farm Bureau. And then we also had Wes Jamison, who's an associate professor of communication at Palm Beach Atlantic University, and he studies these different messages, and I would suggest, after watching him during the show, he's a major bomb thrower. He was very interesting.
So set the scene for me. What was the turnout like for the event? And how did you get things cracking?
Well, it was fascinating because we scheduled this for 4 o'clock on a Friday just a couple weeks ago at Broadway Brew Pub in Columbia. And it just so happens that the NCAA then, you know, brought out the standings. And forgive me, I'm not a sports person.
The bracket.
Thank you. And we were up against the Missouri game at 4 o'clock on Friday. So we just thought, oh, you know, we're toast.
Talk about pink slime.
Exactly. You know, we're in Columbia, Missouri at 4 o'clock on a Friday, and we're not talking about the Missouri game, you know, nobody's going to come. Well, we were really surprised. It was standing room only. We had a packed audience. We had people from all walks of sort of the agriculture spectrum. We had guys from Big Ag. We had the academics from the ag school. We had local producers. In fact, Broadway Brewery serves local food and is committed to that. We had the guys from Farm Aid, from the Missouri Rural Crisis Center, who've been around since 1985. So we just had a ton of different people. And I like to say that there was someone in the audience that commented that virtually everybody was a little uncomfortable at some point. So we really got to the heart of the matter, I think.
Were you concerned at all going in about how special interests would try to steer the conversation or commandeer the conversation or hijack the discourse in a forum such as this?
Absolutely. And someone on the panel did try to do that. So it really sort of proved our point. The animal rights activists kept repeating the same message over and over and over, which is slaughtering animals to eat is immoral. And we kept trying to steer him back to the point of, we're talking about the dialogue of that, you know, the extremism of your view versus the pork producer. And we had her on the other end of the table. So our Reuben Stern was our moderator, and he certainly had a huge challenge in keeping the message on track, as well as sort of keeping these people from not wanting to beat each other up.
Do you get the sense, though, that people even respond to moderate thinkers?
That's a good question. I don't know that they respond to them. I don't know that they get to hear them. And that's the part that I think is really unfortunate. So, for instance, I had reached out on our Harvest Network and said, hey, we're having this talk show in Columbia. What do you guys think about these really disparate messages that you're receiving? And so, for instance, Crystal Yoakum, she's a mother of three from Olathe, Kansas. She wrote in and said, it seems to me we either don't talk about food or we see alarmist articles, internet, Facebook posts that point out the dangers in our food. I think people need a source that is always reliable, that we can refer ourselves and others to for an intelligent discussion of food. I'm hoping Harvest Public Media will be that source. So, yeah, while I don't know that they hear it, they would certainly like to hear it.
And Peggy, we'll be finding out where people fall on this issue as we listen to this playback of the event. Listeners can post their messages at kcur.org or via our Facebook page, or email their comments to centralstandard@kcur.org, and we'll read them later on today's show.
Sounds good. You're going to get a lot.
Now, Peggy, you started off the conversation with a look at a Chipotle commercial. Why did you pick that?
Well, because it's something that's really new that's happening in food right now, and we really haven't seen anything like it before. Chipotle, of course, the fast food burrito company, made this something like 2.5-minute animated message that they posted on YouTube some months ago. And it's basically a cartoon that suggests Mr. and Mrs. Farmer and Baby Farmer and their little pink cylindrical pigs, and they decide to go into factory farming, another hot term. And these pink pigs come out as little pink boxes.
Nobody said it was easy. No one ever said it would be so hard.
And then it ends up with the farmer going back to sort of old school farming.
I'm going back to the start.
Well, it lit up farm country. I mean, Twitter went nuts the day it was posted on YouTube. Farmers were offended, quite frankly, to suggest that, you know, that the farmer turned its back on nature and treating animals well, and were just creating little pink boxes.
Now, what did the guests at the event have to say about this Chipotle video?
Well, when people weren't very offended on either side of the debate, we had Wes Jamieson, an associate professor at Palm Beach Atlantic University, in the middle, and he was basically talking to both sides of it. And he has studied the issue of food production and the dialogue around it at length. And what he said was that every side in these growing food controversies is spinning, and no camp is absolutely accurate. This is his quote. The side that finds a simple term that can be communicated simply, where people understand it, that's relevant to their everyday experience emotionally, and then repeat it enough, they tend to be the ones that win.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 on your FM dial, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. I'm joined by Peggy Lowe, a reporter with Harvest Public Media. Let's fast forward now into the second half of the show and listen back to the program hosted by KBIA's Reuben Stern, who's the host of the station's local program, Intersection.
And welcome back. This is a special edition of Intersection recorded at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. It's a co-production of Harvest Public Media, KBIA, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, with support from Mizzou Advantage and the Food Dialogue Center. Today we're exploring the messages and motives behind food controversies. Joining us are Mike Adams, the host of the syndicated program AgriTalk, Chris Chin, a fifth-generation family farmer, Bruce Friedrich, the Senior Director for Strategic Initiatives at Farm Sanctuary, and Wes Jamison, an Associate Professor of Communication at Palm Beach Atlantic University. Wes Jamison was brought in today by the Food Dialogue Center, an initiative that works with the public and hopes to continue to educate the public about production agriculture. One of the things that's really interesting in the way we talk about farm issues is a game of semantics. For example, biotech versus GMO. Same thing, two different words to describe it depending on who's doing the talking, right? So how is that affecting how informed American consumers are as we try to work through these issues as a society? Wes, I want to throw that one to you first.
Most consumers don't use complex reasoning when it comes to most decisions. Words matter. Is it global climate change or global warming? Is it marriage equality or gay marriage? Words matter. People make decisions based upon shortcuts, and those words provide the shortcuts through which they interpret the debate and the issue. And I would say that the opponents of industrial animal agriculture have been very good at creating words through which consumers begin to view things. For instance, factory farm. In two words, you conjure up all kinds of images that may or may not be accurate, but that in the future provides a filter for consumers to understand the debate. And so it's very, very good communication strategy, actually.
What would you call a factory farm if you weren't going to use the word factory farm?
What I would, gosh, that's a very good question. I would say one of two things. I would say either industrial agriculture has to own the terms factory farm and be proud of it, don't apologize for it, or they have to change the debate into something towards stewardship. Right. There is a very real antecedent for why food production has industrialized. And the reason is Americans want a cheap, affordable food supply. So whether it's in crops or animals, the data indicate that Americans want cheap, safe, readily available food, but they don't want animal abuse. So the problem is Americans want their cake and eat it too. That's why we actually confine animals. That's why we do what we do. That's why we use confinement and intensive systems that look like a factory on animals, is because it produces them cheaply, efficiently, and economically.
Chris, is your farm a factory?
You know, my farm is where I raise my kids. We've got three generations living on my farm. It's been in our family for decades, and it's something we're very proud of. I wouldn't term my farm as a factory or anything. My farm is just that. It's a farm. It's where we work. It's where we live. I think that it's very important for people to understand that farms can be of any size, and they can be of any type, and that there's not a one-size-fits-all description for any family farm. What works for me on my family farm may not work for my neighbor down the road. And it doesn't mean that I'm right, and it doesn't mean that he's wrong. It means that diversity in agriculture is good, and that if our family's able to produce safe food, that's the end goal.
So is family farm the difference on your farm from factory farm? Is that what's different there?
Well, I work with my family every day. I work with my husband, my in-laws, my brother-in-law, and my children. So family is very important to me. So I just talk about my farm as a family farm because in my mind, when I'm on my farm, I'm with my family.
Mike.
I find it interesting that, and it's because many in agriculture didn't like the term a factory that had a negative connotation. What's in a name? Well, that's a negative connotation, except we want products all the time in our society from factories that are produced in factories, and we don't have any problem with it. In fact, we're very concerned when a factory shuts down or when a factory lays off people. That we get all upset about that, but somehow we don't want a farm called a factory. So maybe we should have been calling it all along a food and energy production plant. Does that sound better? I mean, that's what a farm is, really. It produces food and it produces energy. I don't get all hung up about the factory term, except that a lot of people look at it negatively. A factory, to me, produces the goods that consumers want, and that's what a farm does.
Right. In a way, that almost sounds more scary, doesn't it? A food and energy production facility. I'd hate to have one of those by my house, right?
Yeah. And the thing is, most people don't think of a food and energy production system as someplace that animals are housed, but that's also an accurate way of describing how more than 95% of animals are raised. And it's cheap, but it's not what the American people want. And that's where we get back to, I mean, these are factories. And the idea of calling them a factory farm is that the animals are treated like inanimate objects. Nobody in this room would cram your dog or your cat in a tiny little crate for her entire life, force her to go to the bathroom there, give birth there,
right,
nurse her children
Mike,
there.
I'm back on the pigs,
but that's good.
Bruce Frederick gets back on the pigs, so to speak, as he says. Is it fair to even talk about our pets to even make that correlation here?
I don't know that it's fair. I just know that he did it over and over and over again. For instance, in the beginning, he kept talking about whether or not eating animals is moral or immoral. And he said that the majority of Americans are with him. And he said, you know, we wouldn't eat our dogs or cats that we love. Because a lot of the discussion centered around these hog confinement facilities and the gestation crates. And that's what Chris Chin was also talking about.
Let's get back to the event called Digest This, presented by Harvest Public Media, along with partner station KBIA at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri, earlier this month.
Mike, you do agricultural reporting. How do you choose which words you're going to use when you try to inform people?
Yeah, I try to pick more accurate words because there is so much in a name. We're seeing an issue right now, something called, some have labeled pink slime. Well, unless you're maybe a kid who thinks that's pretty neat to eat something that sounds like pink slime, an adult, a parent, probably is going to have a problem with the imagery. That's it. Whether it's good or bad, you could debate, but immediately people shut down. So there's a lot in the name. Biotech, I think if it had started being called biotech to begin with, it would have had a better perception. Genetically enhanced or genetically modified scared people right off the bat. That's how we got all this talk about Frankenfood. You know, all I hear is a lot of talk, well, that may be harmful, or someday they may find out. But what they don't talk about is right now, this technology has been tested and tested and tested, and so far we've found nothing wrong or no safety hazards. And in the meantime, we're producing more food on fewer acres. Society does want more food. We have a growing population, but it also is asking us to do it with fewer acres all the time because we're building on more acres, taking more land out of production all the time. So, again, it's kind of hard. How do you have it both ways? But a lot of it is perception. We have biotech food, you know, ingredients in our food right now, and some people seem to be, you know, you hear about those that protest, but, again, the vast majority, I don't hear those protests from.
And who creates the language? Wes, I'll throw it to you for that one. Who wins in terms of deciding which word is going to be the prevailing word?
Well, all sides do research, spin research, marketing research, advertising research to come up with this. And the side that finds a simple term that can be communicated simply where people understand it, that's relevant to their everyday experience emotionally, and then repeated enough, they tend to be the ones that win. And so when you analyze the messages of animal protection groups, they tend to fit that model. They're simple, they're relevant, and they're repeated over and over and over again. When you look at agricultural messages, they tend to be complex. They have no relevance at all to their target audience's everyday experience, and so they don't stick.
Or they often go up the ladder of abstraction into concepts like freedom, right? I mean, a lot of the big ag ads tend to have fields of wheat with the American flag flying behind, right? That kind of imagery that isn't about specific words. It tends to be much more abstract concepts.
Well, it may be abstract, but it doesn't address the real issue, which is the confinement of animals. And at some point, you actually have to address that issue, and you have to address it in a term that's simple so people can understand, that's relevant, makes sense to their everyday experience, and then repeat it. I can tell you the other side, Bruce's organization, Humane Society, have been very gifted at finding those terms to be able to frame a debate in such a way so when people think of that production practice, that's what they hear.
Mike, go ahead.
You talked about the hypocrisy of us as consumers. Well, what really was the impetus to the biotech revolution for plants in production agriculture? Consumers were concerned about the inputs that were being put out on fields, too many insecticides, too many herbicides. They were concerned about all that. So what did the industry do? Came up with a way to breed that in to the plant.
Okay, we're getting a response from our audience that doesn't signal they agree with you.
We're not idiots.
What do you mean?
We're consumers. We're well-read.
Whoa. Somebody got up in the middle of the conversation with Mike Adams and Wes Jameson talking about they're not idiots. What happened?
Right. It was pretty funny. There was some people in the audience, and they're local farmers. And they are much more of the small production, eat local food kind of farmers. But, of course, they raise animals, so they're much more in the middle. And so, basically, they felt that Mike Adams, the host of AgriTalk, was defending, you know, GMOs. And then what they were saying that they were offended by was Wes Jamison, because Wes Jamison had said most consumers don't know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're doing. He basically, you know, was saying they're really, really super uninformed. And that offended some of our audience members.
Do we get a sense from this conversation that the overall discourse about food production has been hijacked from the rural community and co-opted by academia or the urban community where grocery stores and big businesses are centered, and that sort of distorts the view?
That's certainly what you're going to hear in farm country. Absolutely. You're going to hear that from the farm bureaus. You're going to hear that from the big farmers. You're going to hear that from the big companies that produce and advocate for agriculture, like ADM and Cargill. And that's why everybody's saying out in farm country, hey, get up there and tell your story. Tell people what's going on. Let them into your farms. These so-called ag gag bills that have been passed in many states, where they're basically outlawing those undercover investigations where people, like, you know, take the videos of animals being treated cruelly and post them on the internet. They're trying to outlaw those. They're just saying, you know, those have got to end, and we've got to tell our side of the story, because they believe the mainstream media has bought into more of the organic local food types.
Let's get back to the event called Digest This, presented by Harvest Public Media, along with partner station KBIA at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri, earlier this month.
Well, okay. Well, let's, I mean, in terms of that question of consumers being well-read, what's the right way for a consumer to parse the various messages that they're getting? Let's put it that way. So we do have a lot of well-read consumers in our audience here in Broadway Brewery. I'm sure there are a lot of them listening on our NPR and public television affiliates. How does somebody parse these messages? How does somebody get to realize which languages are being used as emotional triggers and which of them are describing what's going on? How do we parse that in an effective way? If we know that everybody's throwing messages at us that are, you know, slanted to try to get a point of view across. And we'll start with you, Wes, and then we'll hear from Mike as well.
The literature indicates, I know every academic, that's the last refuge of academic scoundrels is the literature. But the literature indicates that most consumers lack the cognitive capability and training to adjudicate this issue. In other words, to rationally think it through. And so what the literature also indicates is when you have competing claims of science, because both sides have their science, don't they? Both sides claim it, that consumers detach from listening to the science and turn to their trusted communities where they have credibility. That's what we find. And that's not necessarily an emotional detachment, but when you have, for instance, I felt like Claude Rains in Casablanca. I'm shocked to find out that scientists with animal protection groups are opposed to confinement. I'm shocked. Likewise, I'm shocked to find out that scientists paid for by the industry are for it.
Can I just chime in for a second?
Yeah, please, and then we'll keep going.
I mean, I think the reason that farm sanctuaries and the Humane Society of the United States and the ASPCA, I think the reason that our messages resonate is that our concern is compassion for animals. Our concern isn't our profit margins. And the reason that we got into these organizations is that we care about how animals are treated. So, yes, on the one hand, shocked that an ASPCA scientist would say these confinement systems are hideous, but they're saying it because the confinement systems are hideous. Whereas, you know, the people who are talking about global warming and they're saying global warming is a problem are by and large disinterested scientists. And the people who are saying, no, it's not a problem at all, are the people who work for, you know, the oil and the drilling companies. Similarly, the scientists who think that cramming a pig or a chicken into a tiny cage for her entire life is just fine for the animal, you know, they're bought off. And that's why they're saying that. And that's why you can't find anybody affiliated with animal protection organizations who would agree. I would say the reason our messaging resonates is that our messaging is right.
Mike, I want to go back to you on that question that we were talking about before in terms of how a consumer is supposed to parse all of these mixed messages that they're getting.
Well, I think they're struggling with that. I think a certain percentage of the audience is very much in one corner, another percentage is very much in the other corner, and it's going to be hard to change their minds either way. The group in the middle, I think, are really asking questions. They want to know. And I think as a pork producer, and Christian, I know, has opened her farm up and tried to talk to people about it, it's up to people in agriculture to explain what they're doing, why they're doing it. And then the customer, the consumer, will ultimately make that choice. I just hope they will make it based on getting the information from all sides, not just one side.
Well, Chris, Mike sort of threw it to you here. If there were one thing that you wish people knew about what goes on your farm and farms, I mean, you're representing a small portion of the agricultural output of this country, right? Most of it is coming from farms a little bit bigger than yours,
right,
to be fair. But in terms of the small farmer that you represent, I mean, what is it that people aren't understanding here that they should be, in your view?
Well, you know, my family, we own our own livestock, and that's contrary to what a lot of people say. They say that, you know, nobody raises hogs anymore on their own, and we do. I'm a consumer, too, and I'm a mom. And so the scare tactics that are being used today, I don't know everything about agriculture either. I know a lot about pigs and cattle. When it comes to other sectors, I'm not an expert. So, you know, I want to study, and I want to find out the accurate information as well, too. If there's one thing that I wish I could tell everybody is that I care about my animals. Their care is our top priority. We're the ones getting up in the middle of the night to care for them. We're the ones who are responsible for them. My husband doesn't eat breakfast of a morning till our animals have been fed first. He goes out and cares for those animals. We're not selfish people. We want to provide food for our family as well for other families as well. My farm may not fit everybody's typical idea of a farm, and that's fine. But I want people to know that I'm not abusing my animals. I care for them. I protect them. I want to make sure that that family farm is there for the next generation to pass it on to my children. I want to make sure that my kids are eating a healthy food product.
And, you know, forgive me for the question if it seems like I don't understand, but how much of that is about protecting the animals because they are an economic asset on your farm as opposed to an actual, what Bruce is talking about, the concern for the animal itself as a sentient being?
Well, we care for those animals. I mean, that's why we moved them indoors, because we were watching the young pigs getting attacked. And we were watching birds track in diseases, and they were getting ill, and we were having to try and find ways to protect them. Hogs can't sweat, and in Missouri summers, it's very hard to keep them cool. We put them inside these barns, and they've got air conditioning. In the wintertime, you know, it's hard for a small pig that weighs 20 pounds to stay warm in 20 degree, 30 degree weather. So that's why we moved them indoors, so that we can help them have a safe environment to live in.
And how representative is what you're describing on your farm, do you think, of all the meat that people are eating out there?
I think all farmers care about the meat that they're producing, whether they're raising their animals outdoors or indoors. There's not a wrong or a right way to do it. As long as you're caring for that animal and making sure that they're protected, I think that's what's right.
Okay, I want to remind our audience real fast that, again, this is a special edition of Intersection recorded at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. It's a co-production of Harvest Public Media, KBIA, and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, with support from Mizzou Advantage and the Food Dialogue Center. Today, we're exploring the messages and motives behind farm controversies. Joining us today are Mike Adams, the host of the syndicated program AgriTalk, Chris Chin, a fifth-generation family farmer, Bruce Friedrich, the Senior Director of Strategic Initiatives for Farm Sanctuary, and Wes Jamison, an Associate Professor of Communication at Park Beach Atlantic University. Mike, I want to ask you a similar question in terms of the farmers that you are in communication with. How prevalent is that concern for treating the animals well as a concern for treating the animals well versus protecting an economic asset among these farms?
Well, I think they go hand in hand, and I mean, you can't ignore, they're in it. It's their job. It's their way of life. I mean, Chris goes about it the right way, but it's also how she supports her family. So that's you can't separate, I don't think, one from the other. And there's no denying there are bad actors out there. There are some that aren't as conscious as they should be of the care of the animals, and those people must be dealt with and can't be condoned that action. But on the other hand, it is her way of life. It is her livelihood, and I am thankful as a consumer that somebody, in fact, she represents less than 2% of the population, feeds the rest of us, not only in this country but the rest of the world. She and others like her do something that most of us either cannot or don't want to do, and that is produce the food that feeds a growing world population. I am thankful for them, for what they do. I want them to do it the best way possible. My difference with Bruce, I mean, we can disagree on production practices. Changes are evolving all the time. Changes will continue to be made in production practices. To me, it's the end game. What's the end game? Is the end game to protect animals and produce the food and fiber and energy that we need, or is the end game to eliminate animal agriculture and eliminate a food source.
Right.
That's my difference.
And we've talked about that divide.
We've heard from Mike and Chris about farm animal welfare and
And we've heard from you about farm animal welfare too, Bruce. I mean, to be fair, we've covered the animal welfare thing pretty well. I want to keep on this question of the information that people get. There's another aspect of that information that I'll let you weigh in on first, the idea of labeling foods with attributes of how the food was produced and how effective that is. And Bruce, I'll give you the opening salvo on that question of would labeling be an effective thing for helping people understand what's going on with their food?
Yeah, and I think that's one area where it seems that we all agree, and that is that people should have eyes wide open as they make these decisions, and they shouldn't take Chris and Mike's word for it, and they shouldn't take my word for it. They should investigate what's actually going on and say, does that resonate for me with what I want to be supporting? And I think for the vast majority of people, when they find out what's happening in these confinement systems, they're going to be opposed to it. One thing that Farm Sanctuary, the Humane Society, and other humane groups are supporting right now is legislation that has about 45 co-sponsors in the House. It's 3798. It will eventually phase out battery cages for hens, and it will, within a year, require that cartons have labels on them that talk about what the production practice was. It's supported by the United Egg Producers, to their credit. It's opposed by the Farm Bureau, the National Pork Producers Council, the National Turkey Federation, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. They're all opposed to it because they think when people see and are confronted with these confinement systems and the slaughterhouse, they're not going to support it. And we think that they may be right.
Michael, your thoughts on this labeling question?
Yeah, I'm not against labeling. The issue you get into, is it a label of information or is it perceived as some kind of a warning? Is it a positive to help you know more information, or is it a negative to try to scare you away from something? So it's always going to get down to how it's put together. I'm not a big label reader myself, but I know some people are, and I'm not against them having all the information. Again, it just gets back to the debate we're having here. Make sure it is accurate, balanced information, and it shouldn't be pushing one way or another. It ought to be there to help the consumer make their decision.
And how do you put balanced information on products when everyone has an axe? Not an axe grind, but an iron in the fire, let's say. Wes, I'll throw that at you.
Not through the USDA.
Really? Why do you say that? They're a government agency? They're supposed to be working on our behalf?
Our behalf. All government agencies have primary interest groups that they serve and support. So the Interior Department is primarily captured by environmentalists. I mean, this is standard operating procedure in ag politics. USDA has traditionally been very, very receptive to agricultural interest groups. Hence, for those of you who followed the food pyramid debate, and any numerous policy issues coming out of the USDA, it tends to have a disproportionate influence by commodity groups. And it's just for reasons of structural issues in our democracy. Any label, here's what I think what the evidence shows, a label has to be concise and simple. So, for instance, 1 star to 5 stars. 5 stars or whatever, 5 stars or a 5-star rating would mean organic, natural, field-raised, no inhumane treatment. 1 would be confinement. What we found is with labels, the label has to be simple and concise, or the average consumer, it doesn't have any relevance. They're price consumers, usually, particularly in poultry. They're price consumers, and even if you label that, consumers aren't overly interested in reading a complex label that has a lot of information. Their food choices aren't being driven primarily by rational central route information. They're being driven by price and a series of sort of shortcuts. So labeling can work. It has to be simple. It has to be concise. So I can look very quickly. Is this humanely raised? If so, on what scale? And then what happens? It becomes politicized because we live in a political culture where interest groups take a dire interest in the outcome. And once you kick it into the USDA, it's going to be a free-for-all by all the groups interested.
Well, that leads to my next question. How likely is that kind of a star system that you just described ever to happen? We might ever see the day where we would have that kind of information as consumers?
Whole Foods has it for their meat, don't they?
I don't know, Bruce.
I think Whole Foods has a 5-star system, although the first star is already better than 99% of meat in this country. The first system is you can't have intensive agriculture for the first. I think the first star is like what Humane Farm Animal Care does right now. Then it goes up to 5 stars, and there aren't very many farms at the 5-star level. Then there are programs like the Animal Welfare Institute has a program that involves labels. And then there are some sort of putting a stamp of approval on the worst abuses, like the Swine Welfare Assurance Program or the United Egg Producers Certified.
Right. I mean, isn't a problem with that, like Whole Foods there's no Whole Foods unless you have an affluent neighborhood, right? I mean, they don't put stores in.
No, it's true. It definitely does price people out, which brings back to, the information. You know, try to visit one of these, farms. Try to visit one of these slaughterhouses, and if you can't get in, ask yourself if you want to support some place that you can't even go look at, because anything having to do with beans, grains, fruits, vegetables, very easy to go see how your food is made.
Well, that does bring up what happened in Iowa legislatively. It's already been mentioned in terms of a law that would make it a crime to misstate on a job application for a farm job whether someone is working for a media enterprise. If they say they're not and then they later film and release that becomes a crime. Chris, I want to ask you about that. How much of a problem would it be if somebody were filming what goes on your farm and putting it on the internet? Why wouldn't they be allowed to do that? Why would you think that's a problem?
Well, we already did film what goes on our farm, and I put it out on the internet. It's a YouTube video so people could see what my family does. We live and we work there, and I'm not ashamed to show people. The reason that we don't allow everybody to walk in off the street into our pig barn is because we don't want to attract diseases into our pigs and make them sick. If any of my family is sick, we have a cold or something, we don't go to work that day. It's not because we want to be a wimp. It's because we don't want to make our pigs sick. We're very conscious of taking care of those animals. We have no problem letting people see what we do on a daily basis because we're proud of where we live and we're proud of where we work and we're proud of the care that we give to our animals.
Mike.
My concern more on the videos, if they find some abuse, it should be addressed right then. My problem is when an undercover video is shot, and abuse is found, and it's that video is not released or authorities aren't contacted for 6 weeks after that. To me, whoever found the abuse and sat on it for that long, for whatever agenda or reasons they did, they're an accomplice. Because if any of us saw an animal being abused at that moment, I would hope we would report it immediately, not wait 6 weeks to do it.
I would challenge people to watch some of these videos and watch the people on camera complaining to their supervisors and their supervisors saying, yeah, that's what happens. Yesterday, PETA released a video. It's on the homepage, PETA.org, and you can watch the guy saying they're really wailing on these cows. And the farm manager says, yeah, that's just what happens. Similarly, when there was an undercover investigator at one of KFC's suppliers of the year, and they were ripping animals limb from limb and jumping up and down on them, he filed report after report after report trying to get something done, and the slaughterhouse operator just refused to do it. I will say that a lot of the 1% farmers, a lot of the very smallest farmers like Nicolette and Bill Nyman, who run Nyman Ranch, they're opposed to these ag gag bills. And if people are not afraid to have what they're doing seen on video, as you said, they should put in cams and say, open it up. This is what happens day to day.
We've just got a little bit of time left. Wes, I want to give you an opportunity to weigh in on this question of the cameras and whether that it represents a problem.
There's two issues. One is transparency. The other one is litigation and legislation. Every industry in the world should welcome transparency, period. Nuclear industry, crop industry. They should welcome transparency. If you can't open your doors and justify what you do, you've got a problem. I don't care what industry you're in. Okay, secondly, the idea about the videos and the ag gag bills. I have profound difficulty with ag gag bills because it kind of violates the First Amendment, right? The intent, sure, it's framed as an employment law so that it's not challenged in the Supreme Court, but the intent is to stop the release of decontextualized videos. That's what it is. That's the intent. So what I would say is, one, it may be unconstitutional. Two, it's not going to stop anybody from shooting the videos. For heaven's sakes, the Florida Turnpike, the speed limit 70, no one goes 70. Everyone's going 85. Since when does a law stop behavior or alter behavior? So we're still going to have mercy for animals shooting videos, and all you're going to do is create martyrs out of the people who are whistleblowers.
Okay, unfortunately, I've got to stop us right there. That's all the time that we have for the broadcast.
We've been listening to an event called Digest This, presented in conjunction with Harvest Public Media and partner station KBIA earlier this month at the Broadway Brewery in Columbia, Missouri. Our guest is Peggy Lowe, reporter with Harvest Public Media. Peggy, I'm going to ask you to stay with me while we take a quick break. And when we return, we'll be taking your calls at 816-235-2888 and reading your messages that you posted in the KCUR.org and on our Facebook page and via centralstandard@KCUR.org. Be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. So far, we've attempted to look at the differences in wordplay between factory farming and food production facilities. We've talked about food labeling and dissected that, so to speak, as we eavesdropped on a recent panel discussion in Columbia, Missouri, called Digest This from Harvest Public Media and NPR member station KBIA. Kansas City, do you feel food production is misrepresented in the public sphere? We'd like to hear from you and get your thoughts and have you join the conversation at 816-235-2888, 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. And joining us for this live part of the hour is Peggy Lowe, a reporter with Harvest Public Media and also a moderator of the Harvest Network's Public Insight Network. Tell us about the Harvest Network.
Well, have you heard the term crowdsourcing as far as journalism goes, Jabalani? I'm sure you have.
Yes.
You're a groovy guy.
I'm groovy enough to have heard of that.
have heard about crowdsourcing, yeah. This is a new way to go in journalism these days. I think that, you know, with the how newspapers have lost so much readership, they learned that you can't just offer our readership and our public, you know, that report and say, take this. We have to have an ongoing conversation every day with our readership, with our listeners. So it's very important to get out into the crowd, to get out into the public and say, what's going on? And help us, you know, create this report. So the Harvest Network is what I do. And I've created a database of, so far, 1,200 people that we reach out to when we're doing stories to say, hey, what's up with this? What's your expertise? What can you share with us that is going to deepen this news report that we're doing? So it's a really cool new way to do journalism.
What tools are you looking for specifically when you solicit comments on the Harvest Network?
Well, for instance, I have spent a lot of time going out to farm shows and county fairs and conventions. I was just up at the Farmers Union Convention in Omaha, their national one. And I sign up real farmers and ranchers and people who are out there growing and producing food in this country. And we want to talk to them about these issues that we're covering. We cover food, fuel, and field at Harvest Public Media. And we want to talk to the people who are actually producing it. I've gone out to National Rural Health Conventions. I've gone to agribusiness folks. So we have, you know, the real public that is doing this, talking to and informing our news report.
Speaking of food, fuel, and field, many would argue that all three are in pink slime, a.k.a. finely textured beef, better known as beef trimmings. What's happening with that controversy? It turns out that Gerald Zernstein, the microbiologist from the USDA, who's from the Kansas area, the Kansas-Missouri region, coined the term pink slime.
That's right. And here's what's interesting. So we had our talk show a couple of weeks ago, and we want to thank you guys for having us on today, by the way. And we talked a bit about pink slime. You know, we're talking about dialogue. We're talking about how do we talk about food. Well, just this week, the makers of pink slime, it's a company called Beef Products International, said they're closing three of their four processing plants because there's been such a huge hubbub about this. I mean, it really got into the mainstream media. Social media went nuts with it. And this company feels as if they have been libeled by the term pink slime because what they use is lean beef trimmings. So it just this is kind of the story that won't go away. And we think it's really fascinating that we had our talk show about the same time this was going on.
Are beef producers bracing for a fallout on this? What can we expect?
Absolutely, Jabalani. There were quick reactions on the Chicago Board of Trade. Beef prices are up. You know, beef prices are really high right now anyway. And so a lot of people in the meat industry said beef prices are going to go up, that this means that more cattle will be slaughtered. This means that it might be harder to get some of the products that this product is in, including like, say, hot dogs and pepperoni and beef sticks and all that stuff you buy at the store. You know, this stuff, this what is what critics call pink slime, is in a lot of what you eat.
And based on what we heard in our broadcast today, what conclusions can we draw concerning the way people think about how their food is produced?
Well, I think that the pink slime drama here is a really good indicator of it. You know, when you say that a product has pink slime, people aren't going to eat it. You know, but if you say it has lean beef trimmings, they're going to. So the way we talk about food is increasingly important. And for instance, We had a guy comment on our Facebook page today. His name is Dan Teagan, and he's a rancher up in Montana. And he wondered how long until pink slime gets rebranded and how it will reappear. He says, my guess is it will be called puce silk, and someone in agribusiness will get a big bonus. And you know, he's not that far off in that the company has said it's going to bring all this production back on in 60 days, and it's going to be coming back out in the market.
I can see it already. Puce silk beef sticks. Get them while they're cold.
That's kind of scary.
And Lori writes in at centralstandard@kcur.org. Of course, food production is misrepresented in the public. Many people would never buy some food if they knew the truth. What do you think of that comment?
Well, I think that's very interesting. You know, I was reading, there's this website for the meat industry, just, you know, really aimed. It's kind of an advocate for the meat industry, and certainly it helps it. And an expert writing there yesterday said to the meat industry, look, you need to admit that the process of making meat products is not pretty, that there's a huge ick factor, and that's what she called it. And you've got to open up your processing plants and other things and show people and be honest. And that would be the best way to go about it, you know, because this is really all about economics, of course. This company is really taking a significant hit on this controversy.
Where did the animal rights discussion versus the food production discussion, at what point do these subjects intersect? They seem to intersect in the forum that we eavesdropped on earlier.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is that most people think that they like their local farmer. They think he or she's a good guy who lives out in the country and has this gorgeous life and, you know, gets to hang out in the barn and commune with the animals. By the same token, I think that the general public tends to think of these agribusiness companies, these large, you know, international companies, as somehow not so good in the making of these processes. That said, those same people are going to stores and buying these products, you know, and then not thinking too much about how they were made. So I think that the intersection doesn't happen for a lot of people that you just mentioned, you know?
Do you get the sense that some consumers want to be disconnected from the production process so that they don't have to think about what happens?
I'm sure that that's possibly true. I can't say that I have been privy to surveys about that. But, I mean, most of us probably just go to the grocery store thinking, okay, what the heck am I going to make for dinner? We don't think about how that pig was treated in the making of the pork chop that we eat that night.
How do you guys over at Harvest Public Media now, in the wake of this panel, synthesize what was discussed in the discussion to foster further discussion on the food production issue?
Yeah, well, we're still talking about it. You know, I have put this question out to my Harvest Network, and people are still talking about it. We have a lot of these pink slime stories up on Facebook and Twitter, and we're having conversations with people there. And we believe that our role and why we really got created about 2 years ago is exactly for stuff like this, in that, you know, here's the business side and here's the meat advocates over here saying this. Here are the animal rights people and the local food producers saying that. We're going to go right down the middle and we're going to tell everybody what's being said and we're going to leave it up to them to decide. So I think a big part of our job is we're the experts in journalism. We'll tell you what's going on and you decide.
Has the USDA weighed in on whether this controversy would create a new labeling paradigm?
USDA hasn't said it's going to be changing any kind of labeling. However, USDA has said often that it's safe. The big thing is it safe? Is it safe? Because what this pink slime process is that they take these trimmings, they warm them up, and they swirl them around, and they get the fat out. Then they douse it with ammonia to clean it of the bacteria that tends to be in these things. So they have said over and over again this process is safe. And the USDA basically is the reason it became huge, because the New York Times some years ago wrote that the USDA bought, you know, gajillions of pounds of this and served it at school lunches, and mothers were outraged.
And the microbiologist that coined that term, Gerald Zernstein, said he doesn't eat beef because, quote, it's not freaking labeled.
Exactly. And that's a question that interests us the most. And so we put that out on our Harvest Network and said, should this be labeled? You know, would you buy it if it's labeled?
Speaking of the Harvest Network, and we have a link on our website that can help you join the Harvest Network. Just visit KCUR.org for that. What do you hear and what had you heard on the Harvest Network chatter about the pink slime?
Well, it's pretty interesting. Some people are really questioning whether or not this is junk science. You know, really? The ammonia cleans it of bacteria? Is that true? So that's interesting. But we've had this conversation for a while on the Harvest Network. For instance, McDonald's recently had these ads about local farmers, you know, kind of trying to capitalize on the fact that we all like Mr. Farmer. And so they're also kind of saying, hey, those French fries you bought down the street at your local McDonald's are local because, you know, a farmer grew it. And some farmers in my Harvest Network thought that was ridiculous. They called it farm washing, kind of like the greenwashing term that people are using. And Tim Zweber, a Minnesota dairy farmer, said, this worries me because farmers currently enjoy a relatively high status of respect from society for the job they do. I really don't like companies or politicians hijacking that respect and using it for their own benefit. So there's certainly even some tension among farmers out there and these agribusiness companies, you know, kind of taking their reputation.
Peggy, speaking of McDonald's, the McDonald's subsidiary Chipotle, whose fresh local farm controversial commercial we looked at during this broadcast, made a statement about local farming and trying to connect their food product to a safe or palatable farm environment. What's the latest on what's happening with Chipotle?
Chipotle is being lauded really in advertising circles for doing something really interesting, which is, you know, first they built this three-minute video with Willie Nelson singing, and then they put it out on YouTube, and then they bought an ad during the Grammys and aired it there. But I think we covered this a bit earlier, but, you know, Farm Country is really angry at Chipotle, and they're saying, you know, you've offended me, and I'm never buying a burrito there again.
What were you most surprised about in the way this event digest this turned out?
I was surprised at the real heat, at the real anger. You know, we had some people in the audience who afterwards were offended because they said that they didn't like the way we put the panel together, that there was another voice missing, and that is the voice of sort of the middle-sized farmer who grows sustainably some pork products and sells them locally. And, you know, we didn't have that person on the panel, but we wanted to talk about the extremes of this dialogue and those two sides that hijack that conversation.
Peggy, we had Julianne write in from Raytown that essentially saying consumers want labels. They want to know what the USDA deems safe.
Mm-hmm. I mean, most of us do want to know what's in the products. And labeling is the next big issue, I think. You know, we've had a lot of food safety concerns with, you know, these listeria outbreaks, among other things. And I think labeling is going to be the next hot topic for the USDA to have to combat.
Peggy, our next Harvest Public Media KCUR simulcast will be on May 24th from Iowa Public Radio with host Charity Nebbe. What are you going to chat about?
Well, that's going to be really fun. We are working on a big series about the farmer of the future. And again, on my Harvest Network, if you go to harvestpublicmedia.org and just click on Harvest Network, I've got a query up there that says, is the farmer of the future a corporation? You know, is it Cargill? Is it these big producers? But we're doing an entire series and we're doing a documentary about the farmer of the future. That's what we're going to be talking about in Iowa City.
Peggy Lowe is our guest. She's a reporter with Harvest Public Media. As we mentioned, the next Harvest Public Media themed talk show will be May 24th on the Farmer of the Future from Iowa Public Radio with Talk of Iowa host Charity Nebbe. Tune in to Central Standard that day to hear that broadcast. Thank you, Peggy, for coming on Central Standard today for this broadcast.
My pleasure, Javelani.
And tune in tomorrow as we delve into the seedy and often whimsical world of public relations. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next as psychologist Wes Crenshaw joins Steve Kraske for a chat about parents, teens, and technology. I'm Javelani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.